I'm Josh Cohen.
I'm Alexandra Edwards.
I'm Corey Gergen. And this is Technically Pop. Okay, and we're back for our first show of the new year, of the new decade.
2020, it's like so future-y.
2020, right? And we have a topic that is future-y as well. We're going to talk about Star
Excuse
Wars.
Excuse you, this is the past.
Yes, a long time ago.
In the past.
You know, in my head, I was thinking that, and then I thought, I'm just going to say it anyway, and no one will call me, but I forgot the room that I was in. We are going to talk about a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. We're going to talk about the Skywalker.
Sorry, I'll never do that
good.
Again.
That was no, that's saying.
Think you owe Disney $5.
I would like to deposit it directly into John Williams' retirement account because the man is old. He deserves a rest.
He's headed to the Grey Havens.
He's still doing excellent work. I just think he deserves a rest. You can put it down for a while, John.
So as you can hear, we're very excited to talk about this, but we just, as we always do, blanket spoiler warnings. We're going to spoil, we could spoil anything regarding Star Wars. We might spoil Watchmen. And if you haven't watched Watchmen, go watch Watchmen. But we're going to get into it. So I thought we'd start by going around and just talking about our own personal histories with this universe, and then we could get into the actual conversation about the Skywalker saga.
Yeah.
So I was the perfect age for the remastered, digitally remastered 1997 re-release, 20th anniversary, all three films in the theaters. So I was like 9, 10 when they were coming out. So all in that year, basically another generation of, you know, being a kid, seeing Star Wars, falling in love with it instantly, getting all the action figures, which I still have in a box at my parents' house, even very obscure ones, you know, that aren't from the movies. I read 50 Star Wars novels, give or take. I've been reading some of the new comic books, you know, playing the new video games, Jedi Fallen Order, all that stuff. Obviously, saw the prequels in theaters. So since I was a kid, always loved Star Wars, very important to me, important mythology, very formative, yeah.
Wow. So it's very important for me to say up front that I grew up in a Star Trek family. that was a very sort of specific cultural divide, going on in my household. That being said, I did watch the original trilogy as a child. I had an Ewok stuffed animal. I had the Ewok adventure taped off of television and would watch it, I think, probably frequently. I saw The Phantom Menace in theaters and it did not speak to me. Again, we were a Star Trek family. It just didn't grab me. And I'm a little bit older than you are, Josh, so I think I was probably 13 when, 14 maybe, when Phantom Menace came out. And then my shameful confession is that I actually have never seen episodes 2 and 3.
Wow.
Excellent.
I've heard a lot about them. I'm married to an incredibly active Star Wars nerd. So when the new trilogy came out, when Force Awakens came out, we sort of jumped back into the Star Wars universe and got really invested in it. And I've been invested in the new stuff to an extreme degree. But I've held out of not watching 2 and 3.
I wouldn't persuade you otherwise.
Okay.
I will say 3 is, it has some cool moments. It has some things that are worth watching, particularly the final sequence, which the always provocative Camille Paglia has described as like the pinnacle of 21st century multimedia art. It's good. Ewan McGregor makes it. I mean, he's transcending all the flaws with the writing, and he's doing some his performance is pretty cool.
See, the thing that annoyed me about that is that I was a huge Ewan McGregor fan literally at the moment that Phantom Menace came out, and I was very mad that Star Wars had made it so that he could not show his dick in movies anymore. That's sort of where I was. history.
Ewan McGregor is the least, embarrasses himself the least of all the actors in those movies. I have liked Star Wars since before I was fully capable of understanding full movies.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned something similar, but when you all were kids, did you have like homemade taped movies?
Oh yeah.
Off of HBO?
Oh, hundreds in my house.
Yeah, that was just like there was a cabinet of
VHS's VHS recorded TV stuff.
Of like when my dad had HBO for a month at some point. Right.
No, they would do like the free month and you could just record everything.
That's exactly right.
And you would do it at lower quality so you could get three movies on a tape.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we had a tape with what I now know were Return of the Jedi and another tape with Empire. But they just said Star Wars on the side. And I think I would just put them in, and wherever they were, that's what I would watch, and that would be Star Wars. So, like, I was really into the Cloud City stuff in Empire. I was in love with Jabba's Palace.
Sure.
I once argued with my aunt because she put Empire on for me at her house, and I said, there's no snow in Empire Strikes Back. and later... I was like one Christmas when they would all come on TBS or whatever, I watched them all through and I got into the novels. I read probably more than 10, but fewer than 25 of the novels. I tapped out around the time that like Princess Leia was being courted by some like rich prince and had to like consider marrying him.
Yes, for the Prince of the Hapes Consortium.
Yes. That was, I think, the time that I was like, but I loved many of those novels. Went to see the special editions in the theaters. I was a teenager. The prequels, I think The Phantom Menace was like, I was in high school. It was like, I think the first time that my parents did away with whatever my curfew was so that I could go to the midnight showing with friends.
Yeah.
I was a very dangerous youth, clearly.
Yeah.
And didn't connect. I tried to convince myself for a long time that I liked those movies. Kept going to see them. And now I've been back into the new Disney stuff. Less likely to try to talk myself into liking it, I suppose.
Interesting. It's interesting to me that a lot of the history of like our generation's engagement with Star Wars is not a linear kind of engagement, right? That it's sort of piecemeal. And when it comes to us, it comes to us and we see it. But there's not a sense of like someone sits you down and you watch episodes 4 through 7 in order, right? It's such a fascinating, like, massive piece of storytelling that it's hard to know, like, who's got what piece of information, right? Like, who knows what?
Yes.
You know?
And the original trilogy is so episodic that it can work that way. I mean, it's like by design, right? It's every 20 minutes they're doing something else.
Right.
In a very clean and easy way to follow with whatever level of engagement that you want, right? So it works for a 5-year-old, it works for a 13-year-old who wants to get really obsessive about Salacious Crumb, which I did for... I'm sure that I had nightmares about him chewing on C-3PO's eyeball at one point. It was the first cute thing that was also scary, I think, that I've ever seen.
Oh, see, that's how I felt about the Labyrinth, the characters in the Labyrinth Salacious Crumb, because it's all Jim Henson, right?
Right.
And they're the ones who, like, they can remove their heads, and they tell Sarah, like, well, why don't you just remove your head? And she's like, my head doesn't work that way. That's how I felt about
that. I wouldn't have slept for a month. I'm so glad I didn't see that.
I'm really sorry if I traumatized you now as an adult.
No, I'm gonna deal with it now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, obviously, we are here in the first month of 2020, and in the last month of 2019, 42 years of storytelling came to an ostensible end? Question mark? With this ninth film of what Disney is now calling the Skywalker Saga. And I'm wondering, now that we can look back on the cycle as a whole, what do we think of it? Specifically, what does the Skywalker Saga tell us about our culture or media or entertainment or any of these sorts of big, high-level questions? Just silence. Is that too large of a question to try to tackle?
Well, my initial answer is not a productive answer, but my initial answer is that it teaches us that the internet was a mistake.
Actually, I'm going to agree with that 100%.
No, I think it's hard to talk about it now because it's so infected by... Like, it's hard to talk about the movies as a distinct thing from the conversation about the movies. Like, we were texting earlier this week to plan this, and we were talking about Star Wars fatigue, and I said I'm fatigued by everything except Mando and Baby Yoda. Mm-hmm. But it's just I'm fatigued by the endless conversation.
The discourse.
About the discourse the strikes again.
Yeah.
I think, we'll come at this a few different ways, I'm sure, but one way to think about this is... George Lucas, in reflecting in Empire Dreams, which is one of the great documentaries about the making of the original trilogy, he reflects in this like kind of moment of like irony or circumspection that the whole story of Anakin's fall to the dark side, which is, of course, is what he is most interested in, right? He goes back and does the prequels. He doesn't continue Luke's story. He chooses to go back and tell the rest of Anakin's story, even though we all know where it's headed. He felt... In some ways, the irony that was his own story, in the sense that he started out as this maverick creator, independent filmmaker, someone who was giving the finger to the studio system. Mm-hmm. Famously, Spielberg doesn't direct Return of the Jedi because that would have caused friction with the Directors Guild. The whole opening credit the whole lack of an opening credit sequence, you know, that was like mandatory at the time. You got to show the billing right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Lucas is like, no, I'm going to do this crawl. It's going to be like old World War II serials. I'm going to have this really awesome cold open where you're in space. You see a ship that becomes part of the Star Wars, you know, cinematic language, right? Mm-hmm. We all recognize that. It sounds so ridiculous now to think that that caused any type of controversy or that that was revolutionary, because it's just so accepted that you can do a cool cold open and plug the credits in somewhere else. But
well, you do still have to pay extra.
You do, yeah.
There is like a monetary
right.
Remuneration
right.
If you're going to hold the credits till the end.
For sure.
But certainly many movies make that trade-off.
Yeah.
They're happy to. Particularly the Marvel films. Happy to do that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Lucas, you know, he's got these bold ideas. He's shooting on location in insane places. You're not supposed to shoot on location. Everyone tells him, don't shoot in snow. Of course, we have Battle of Hoth. You know, he goes to North Africa to shoot this Tatooine stuff. It's a nightmare. Like, there's sand everywhere. It's the desert, right? All this bold filmmaking. And what ends up happening? He ends up creating Industrial Light and Magic. He ends up forming a corporation. It becomes a huge success. There's all these licensing agreements. There's an empire of toys, right? And he in the documentary, he notes that what happens to Anakin? He sets out to defeat the bad guys, and then he becomes Darth Vader, the Dark Lord of the Sith. Lucas, he sets out to make something with his own creative vision, and he ends up becoming what? A corporation, a brand, a studio. So I think one way to look at the Skywalker saga is precisely that. The story of going from... Lucas is this guy in Modesto, Northern California. He's supposed to be running his dad's hardware store. He's dreaming of, you know, he's reading Joseph Campbell or whatever. He's dreaming of the hero's journey. And he was at some point probably read Dune, and he was watching Kurosawa films. And he's thinking about these big archetypal stories, coming of age, being part of something, a code, right? Like a samurai code. So he tells this story. And a lot of the story of Star Wars is technical innovation, right? It's like, how do we make this model on a string look like a ship flying through space for the first time that anyone had ever done that?
Right.
And then we get to, you know, flash forward to 2012 or whatever, when Disney acquires the rights. And so there's a lot of directions Star Wars could have gone. Lucas could have kept making more movies. He could have handpicked a successor, you know, the way that like Frank Herbert or Robert Jordan, you know, when you're writing a big fantasy epic or sci-fi epic and you die, you know, your estate has to select someone to continue your 20 million book. I'm sure this will happen to George R. R. Martin because he'll never finish Game of Thrones, right? He could have done that. I mean, there's a lot of ways it could have gone, but the way that it goes is the biggest corporate entity of them all, Disney, which is trying to eat everything in media, takes it over and is like, we are going to make this one corner of our empire. So I think that's one thing we can look at is this trajectory from an individual idiosyncratic filmmaker with an idea that no one thought would work at the time, mm-hmm. to the biggest media company out there making it their flagship or a flagship brand, and they're trying to do something with it, to mixed results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a really fascinating read, I think, and it takes us out of the sort of geopolitical questions, right, of what Star Wars like represents in terms of how we think about conflict, and instead I like this sort of focus on, I'm fonder maybe of the 9 film cycle if I think about them in that way that you've just outlined, so thank you.
There you go.
I
think that's right, and I think you want to talk about Mary Sue's, let's talk about being George Lucas and naming your chosen one Luke.
Yeah, sure.
Right, sure. And I think just as the story of Anakin is the story of this like wily creative genius who doesn't listen to his mentors becoming the empire that he once resisted, right? The story of Luke mm-hmm. is very much the story of that character succeeding,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
This is also in Beast.
But see, I'm also frustrated by that reading though, because all of these massive films made by these sorts of groundbreaking quote-unquote auteur filmmakers, they're all movies about making movies, right? This is all of Nolan's entire career is making movies, about the process of making movies. Like, it frustrates me how insular the stories that these big filmmakers get a chance to tell really end up being. Right, as true as that, as apt as the reading may be, and as willing as I am to go with that theoretical thread, can we just? I don't know. I mean, I also want Star Wars to tell me something about
the world.
Star Wars,
yeah,
the wars and the stars, right?
Right.
When there will be star peace?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there can't be.
Right.
There can't be star peace because it's in the title.
Yeah. So this is. This is not to fatigue us with the discourse, but this is thinking back to Force Awakens, right? Which we have to acknowledge is a huge hit.
Yeah.
2 billion plus. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is, of course, there had been a dearth of Star Wars content. It's back for the first time in a long time. It's very flashy. It's J.J. Abrams. J.J. knows how to make a flashy movie.
He knows how to put together an ensemble of characters.
Great casting.
Introduce them in such a way that you care about what's going to happen to them.
Yeah, you wonder what's going to happen next. Yeah. The thing is, with Disney, with Force Awakens, they make this decision that some people have argued out there in the ether dooms this trilogy.
You won't name them, but just some people.
Yeah, some people in the ether. Because at this point, I've read so many takes on this, I can't remember how many people who to attribute this to. But some people have argued you doom the whole thing by having it reset and remaking A New Hope, right? That instead, so with the old EU, with the novels and the comics, all this stuff that I grew up loving because there was no other movies, and when the prequels came out, they were such a disappointment. And these were the things that carried the story forward, right? What happens? Oh, Luke created a Jedi Academy, a new generation of Jedi, new bad guys, etc., right? Mm-hmm. The idea of a new republic that was under threat is really the premise of most of those books. And then it takes different forms, and there's new conflicts and new villains. But that's the basic premise, is that the Empire has been defeated, and there are remnants to fight. And there are schisms within this new republic, and there are new Jedi, and they're always in danger. There's always going to be villains, right? There's always going to be danger. But there's a kind of philosophical difference between, there's a fascist government that controls everything, and there's an insurgent group fighting them, which is a story that had been told.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between that, and then, the Jedi succeeded, Luke succeeded, there's now a new republic, which in theory existed in this interim, right, between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens, which we have not seen on screen. We may see in a Disney Plus series, maybe, who knows? There's comics about it, right? There's new comics about what Luke was doing and being a great Jedi and all this stuff. I wonder if philosophically the decision to remake A New Hope, as successful as it was commercially, kind of put them behind the eight ball, because it forces them to try to retread some of the same terrain, try to do some of the same moves, instead of saying, what problems would a Jedi Order have, right?
Right.
Obviously, we see that in the prequels to some extent. But I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Do you wish that this new trilogy had taken a different direction from the beginning? Or do you just wish it had been executed differently? Or what do you think?
I think that it's very telling that they did decide to, number one, bring J.J. Abrams on. But number two, to then mine the... I think there's something specific about this moment. Force Awakens comes out in 2015.
Yes.
Nostalgia.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. There is something about the cultural power of nostalgia.
They definitely made that decision. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And in making that decision are participating in a larger sort of recurrent cycle of
Stranger Things, remaking Ghostbusters.
Even more explicitly, yeah. So many of these remakes are set in the ruins of the sets of the old movies, right? The Jurassic World.
Yeah.
Reboot. This new Ghostbusters, right, where the old Ecto-1 is hiding somewhere.
I just don't know that... I don't know that it would have occurred to them to not do that. Yeah, to do it in a different way. Would it have been more interesting? Possibly. Would it have forestalled or helped to usher us past this current wave of nostalgia? Maybe. I don't know. But it seems now, and maybe this is a kind of teleological reading of this, but it seems now impossible to think of them not just dipping into that nostalgia pool.
Bob Iger said in his recent book that he just released a few months ago, he says something along the lines of, look, we looked at what people liked. They loved the original movies. We read the reviews for the prequels. Everyone hated that. That was terrible. Now, there is a sizable portion of the fan culture who will defend the prequels. Most of the general audience did not like them. Obviously, the originals were a key hit. So they looked at that and they said, oh, we need to just reverse engineer whatever people liked. So let's make them feel like it's 1977 again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's also, this is not going to be an exclusively meta reading, but there's all, so I apologize in advance, Alex, but like all those, I think J.J. Abrams has said something like this, but like I buy it, that the weight of doing it, of doing this at all, must have been immense. And so like all those shots of Rey alone in the wreckage of the Star Destroyer read as like really like J.J. working through his own feelings about doing it. So mm-hmm. This is not answering your question, Josh, which is this a mistake? It probably was a mistake, but I don't know. Not just because...
That it has an autobiographical lens.
Well, but just what else would you do with this universe except sort through the wreckage of these movies that everyone loves?
Okay, this is interesting to me. This is an interesting question because we actually have a sizable data set now at this point. Because we have J.J. Abrams making two Star Trek movies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We have him making two Star Wars movies. Mm-hmm. We have his sometimes collaborator Damon Lindelof making Watchmen. we're getting a growing sample size of taking something. Now, Watchmen doesn't quite have the weight to the entire culture that Star Wars does. Excuse me. But it does have the weight to a certain group of people. So the interesting thing is, in the 2009 Star Trek reboot, I think J.J. does a pretty good job of retelling, right? He introduces this time travel plot, mm-hmm. and you have Kirk and you have Spock, and the casting is great, and you have another way of introducing, it's kind of an alternate origin story. Mm-hmm. The whole thing about J.J. is he's really good at origin stories, he's really bad at everything else, right? Yes. So he does this pretty successfully. Then he does Into Darkness. Also, pretty cool movie. Also, same kind of thing.
Disagree. Okay. Wholeheartedly.
Spoken like a Star Wars fan.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, even with...
it's more Star Wars-y. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Even with the 2009 Star Trek, right? The critique from the actual sort of Star Trek fandom, the people who were still invested in Star Trek, qua Star Trek.
Yes.
Right.
There's not enough standing around on a planet.
Yes,
absolutely. Totally.
It's too fast paced, right?
Totally.
And Star Trek is stately
and
somewhat boring.
If they thought that was fast paced, wait till we talk about Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
My point is, he has experience doing this exact thing. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason I think it fails is that they just do this too quickly. They try to make 3 movies in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they are completely erratic in their executive decision making, mm-hmm. right? So they do Force Awakens. There's no plan for what the next movie is going to be, mm-hmm. because then they give Rian Johnson complete creative control. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to do that, if you want to do Star Wars by committee, why make it a trilogy? Why not just say J.J. Abrams is going to do a movie, and Rian Johnson is going to do a movie, and Colin Trevorrow or whomever is going to do a movie, and they're all going to stand alone, mm-hmm. and we're going to churn out Star Wars movies just because, honestly, we want to start making back our investment.
Yeah.
And then maybe we'll start thinking about a longer story. Maybe we can take some of these characters from each of these movies and tie them into something bigger. Or you need to wait. Mm-hmm. Develop a story that's a 3-movie arc. Yeah. And if you still think these 3 directors are going to execute this larger story, that's fine, right? The MCU didn't start out with this perfect formula. They kind of backed their way into it, right? They made Iron Man. It was a hit. They made another one. Less of a hit.
Let's not name it.
Listen, I am the guy who likes The Matrix Reloaded. I like Iron Man 2. I like Batman versus Superman. But even I am not fully on board with Rise of Skywalker. So maybe that says, you know, a certain thing. But my point is,
I was thinking about the Hulk movie that they make second.
Oh, yeah.
With Ed
Yeah,
Martin.
That one should not be named. Yeah, yeah. You're right about that.
Sorry.
You're right about
Let's
that.
Let's bleep it out.
I forgot it existed.
But they get to this formula over time, right? It mm-hmm. takes them many movies. It takes them a Kenneth Branagh Thor origin movie that then they decide, oh, that wasn't that great. It takes them to Winter Soldier. Mm-hmm. And they land on a writing and directing and producing team that mm-hmm. then they realize this is the formula. Critics like this movie. Mm-hmm. Audiences like this movie. Mm-hmm. It took them a lot of tinkering. And then they got there. And then they're like, this is it. This is the new thing. We're going to map this out, right? If Disney had given themselves the chance to either map out a longer story or just do a bunch of random Star Wars stories that aren't necessarily connected, mm-hmm. right? You wouldn't have the problems that they had with making this trilogy make sense. And the whole Skywalker saga thing, I mean, it's just a marketing thing, right? Like,
yeah.
Nothing ended.
Yeah.
Right?
Which was my
Rey
serious.
Ends the movie by being like, I'm Rey Skywalker. Yeah. I'm claiming this identity. I have a new lightsaber. Like, in 10 years, Daisy Ridley will be back to do the further adventures of Rey.
Right. I think, based on John Boyega's social media activity over the last couple of weeks, his relationship to the Star Wars universe ended, but nothing
Oscar
else.
Isaac, too. Yeah. Ended. They're pissed.
Yes. So, just one quick conspiracy theory. I don't buy that they didn't have a plan for the trilogy.
You don't think so?
I think they had a plan. They had a
and
plan.
And this was it?
No.
Oh, okay.
I think that they had a plan, and that plan involved getting 3 movies done in 5 years. 4 years? 4 years.
5 years.
5 years.
Yeah.
With A-list directors, and that meant 3 different directors, but that there was a plot arc every bit as substantial as what George Lucas had when he made A New Hope, and maybe even when he made The Phantom Menace. I think that they lost their nerve after The Last Jedi.
They scrapped it.
And they tried to do something
but,
different.
But how does that square with the difference between Force Awakens and Last Jedi? Because they told Rian Johnson he could make whatever he wanted.
I don't think those differences are as significant as people say. And I don't buy
you
that.
You think they told J.J. that there was some communication between J.J. and Rian?
There was some communication. I think that Rian Johnson did not have final cut on that movie. I think that he was getting things okay.
Well, the thing... So part of what has come out is that, in theory, he was going to write the 3rd movie.
Yeah.
And maybe direct it. And then supposedly, once they were like, no, actually, you're not going to direct the 3rd movie, then he made some changes to The Last Jedi to say, okay, if this is my only shot, I want to make this particular.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right, right. Yeah. I think it's also important to remember, though, within the context of the process of making these films, right, that Disney does originally kind of structure an anthology-esque thing into the new trilogy, which is that the first episode is Han's
yep.
movie,
yep. Mm-hmm.
the second episode
yes.
is Luke's movie,
yep.
and
right.
then they meant for Rise of Skywalker
right.
to be Leia's
yes.
movie.
100%.
It wouldn't have even been called Rise of Skywalker necessarily. That title comes much later. And unfortunately, we lose Carrie Fisher
sure.
before that can happen, right? So in part, there's a scramble to recontextualize what do we do with the fact that she's now gone.
Sure.
The anchor of our film is now gone.
That does pose
problems. The culmination
yes.
of the emotional arc of the films is gone.
Yeah.
But I agree that forcing yourself to continue to meet the 2019 deadline then becomes a kind of a fool's errand. A decision that makes sense from a risk-averse business point of view, doesn't make sense from a creative point of view, because Rise of Skywalker, top to bottom,
has story problems.
T2B has story problems, and is the kind of cake that needed to be in the oven longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, just quickly about the whole comparison to Lucas and Disney, right? Lucas's thing was he had too much story.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. He had so much story that he realized this isn't one movie, this is two movies, right? And he made Star Wars, right? A New Hope, Episode 4, 1977. And then he had a chance when it was such a success to make a sequel. And then he realized that what he thought was the second movie was also two movies, right? Mm-hmm. And then when he gets to the end of Empire and Jedi, he thinks, you know, one day when the technology catches up, I'd like to tell the rest of the story, which is Anakin's story. Mm-hmm. And in theory, he had mapped some stuff out. And in fact, he gave Disney scripts for Episode 7, which they were not too keen on making, probably because George Lucas is an idiosyncratic, weird guy with really, really deep interest in Force theory, and they didn't want to go that direction.
I didn't want to go that direction either. Just
if full disclosure. I had to hear the word midichlorians one more fucking time.
But yes, so what became A New Hope was originally had a full trilogy of things in it, but while he was making A New Hope, Darth Vader is not Luke Skywalker.
That's true. Yeah. Occurs to him in the moment. Yeah.
While he's making Empire Strikes Back, Leia is not Luke's sister.
Yeah, that's right? True.
And I think this idea that, oh, if only we had three scripts when we set out, I don't think that would have solved the problems of this trilogy.
I guess, yeah, that's a really good point. I guess the difference is, I think they felt the compulsion to have a twist or to change things from The Last Jedi that that I primarily disagreed with, right? So the idea that we haven't even said it yet, but spoiler alert, Rey is the granddaughter of Emperor Palpatine. What connection has she had to a guy who has never been in these movies? So I buy that maybe they talked about Palpatine, that maybe somebody read Dark Empire, which is a great and super weird comic where Luke decides the only way to beat the dark side is from within, and he apprentices himself to the clone emperor, and I have the action figures of Dark Side Luke and clone emperor Palpatine, which I can show you guys later. It's bananas, and they... Somebody probably took that and was like, yeah, well, let's bring the Emperor back. There is nothing, there's his voice in one snippet of Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. You cannot convince me that they really thought this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in Last Jedi to suggest that he's out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so to bring him in at the end to try to create some kind of closure, to make it feel like this larger story that he was always out there, they didn't lay enough groundwork. And right. I think they also, there's just so much chaotic stuff with firing, you know. They fire Lord and Miller off Solo. They bring in Ron Howard, right? They fire Trevorrow. They bring J.J. Abrams back. Like, they just were indecisive. And that's not the mark of a creative team that's like, we have a story we're trying to execute.
And this is why I don't fully believe that Rian Johnson made every decision in The Last Jedi, is that they fired many people off of many of these movies, right?
Right.
And so I think maybe it's one of those things where he had the full freedom to do what he wanted, so long as what he wanted to do was what Disney also, you know what I mean? Like, there's like ways that language gets muddy.
Oh, there's, this is filmmaking by committee, and I don't care how much they wanted to tout that these individual filmmakers were writing and directing these films. It's filmmaking by committee.
Yeah.
There's nothing to suggest that Disney approached The Last Jedi in any way differently than they approach any Marvel movie since that acquisition or any of the other Star Wars movies. At every step of the process, Rian Johnson was subject to the creative control and guidance of Story Group, Kathleen Kennedy, and everyone else whose names we don't even know because filmmaking relies on hundreds of people whose names you will not know to make decisions, right?
And it's focus grouped to death.
Yes.
Shortly.
Yes.
Not to death, because it's a lovely film. It's actually very much alive. But it was heavily... Right, I mean, I feel like he's an easy scapegoat for everyone that isn't happy with this trilogy in terms of the quality of the films, in terms of the profitability of the films, it just becomes easy to go, oh, Ryan made those decisions, and Ryan's gone. So come back and love Star Wars again.
Right. And in fact, what we got is another sort of nostalgia fest.
Yes.
That is fun in the moment and then empty the second it finishes and you start to think about what the actual story decisions were with
you
Ryan
guys,
Skywalker.
I have to confess, though, that I left the theater when Chewie died, so I don't even know. I don't know what happened. The rest of the what happened in the rest of Rise of Skywalker?
He must have been on a different transport.
Yeah, yeah. I'm obviously kidding. The thing with Rise of Skywalker, right, is it doesn't take any of the risks that Last Jedi takes.
Yes.
Chewie should have died, for instance. The idea of Rey using Force Lightning, you need to delve into that. It can't just be one scene where she just talks to a droid, basically. And then that's it. You need to grapple with these things.
She has like 17 new force powers in this film.
Yeah, so there's force healing.
Right.
She uses force lightning unprompted.
Somehow two lightsabers together.
She passes the lightsaber. She can deflect force lightning. She passes the lightsaber to Kylo, which is very cool. It's a cool moment. Yeah.
And I don't think we would be complaining about those things if the movie was narratively satisfying. But it... And
sure, yeah.
The reason... Like, it was cool when she passes the lightsaber. Also, I think that connection makes sense from a narrative perspective.
Yes, the Rey Kylo stuff is good.
Right.
And from a performance, like, those are great performers who have interesting chemistry together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has interesting chemistry with a wall, but... That's beside the point.
He has interesting chemistry with his own pants. Let's just be real.
With his mask. I mean, really, everything.
That silly mask in this movie.
This movie does one thing consistently, which is that it fundamentally changes the stakes of the universe. Mm-hmm. It changes who's alive, what pieces, what props are whole and complete, and it immediately backtracks on those decisions, whether they were made in Last Jedi or whether they were made in the moment in this movie itself, right?
Over and over again.
Over and over again. So Rey has rebuilt her lightsaber off screen.
Rebuilt Anakin Skywalker's lightsaber, which has now been lost and found and destroyed and remade. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Exactly. All off, most of this off screen without any explanation of how that is even possible. Right. Rebuilds Kylo's mask, kills Chewie, then revives him, wipes 3PO, then immediately gives him back his memory.
Mm-hmm. Destroys a planet, but then rescues everyone that we cared about from that planet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but Babu Frick did nothing wrong.
No, I know.
It's important for me to say that.
None of this is Babu Frick. Nobody's mad at Babu Frick.
2020.
Literally no one is mad at Babu Frick. But again, right, like you think you're watching Carrie Russell and Babu Frick die.
Right.
And then they show up with the cavalry at the end.
Don't worry, we're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. With Lando, who we thought we left behind to face certain torture from the First Order, but he's fine too.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is the mark of a film that doesn't trust its own narrative arc. Yeah?
Arcs. Plural.
Plural arcs.
Because there's
right.
about seven.
You're not wrong. You're absolutely not wrong.
I guess another... So again, thinking about this in the context of the broader saga or whatever, I think one of the reasons that makes the original trilogy so good is it's a way for kids and also adults, primarily for kids, right, to think about loss,
mm-hmm.
right? The first movie, Luke faces the loss of his newfound mentor, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Mm-hmm.
The second movie, he faces really the loss and this traumatic confrontation with Vader, who mm-hmm. Becomes his father. So it's the loss of what he thought was his father as being this long dead heroic Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the final movie, his father dies and sacrifices himself. So all the way through, there's different kinds of losses. And it's a way, sci-fi and fantasy are always a good way to process sort of real world, complicated emotional issues, things like death, things like, you know, mourning and grief, things mm-hmm. like that. What you're saying about the way that Rise of Skywalker keeps reversing itself is it refuses to do that. Right. It refuses to kill off Chewie, not because we don't like Chewie. Chewie's beloved character. That's precisely why Rey should be forced to reckon with her powers.
Yes.
It's unique. Part of Star Wars is coming of age, and part of coming of age is being aware of things like death, things like tragedy. An entire planet is destroyed, and Princess Leia has to watch, and it's her planet, and she knows her parents are there, and she can't do anything, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much sadism on the part of Tarkin, and there's so much vulnerability on Leia's part, right? These are, like, deep, important issues that, because it's in a sci-fi context, a space fantasy context, you can't always just talk to kids about genocide, right? But in a distance context, kids are able to think about that, and that's part of the transition to adulthood is being a kid, you don't have to think about the horrors of the world. Being an adult, you sort of have to, right? Mm-hmm. So coming-of-age stories are always moving us along that path. Mm-hmm. In this film, Rey is let off the hook for, you know, thinking that she's killed Chewie. Mm-hmm. Everyone is collectively let off the hook by having to think of a droid, C-3PO, mm-hmm. as having sort of moral status, like a mm-hmm. human. Like, yeah. It could be immoral to erase his memory. Mm-hmm. Because then he gets it back. Because R2, right. he just has it and whatever. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like, it's pretty funny, right? It's pretty funny when C-3PO says, like, Babu Frick, one of my oldest friends. There's some funny yeah. lines of dialogue that they get out of this stuff, but it sacrifices the integrity mm-hmm. of the story. And there's too many little things that's like, okay, you clearly just did this. It's, like, I timed it. When I watched the movie the second time, it's under 3 minutes from when you think Chewie gets blown up to when you see him on mm-hmm. the First Order yeah, ship.
It's mm-hmm. very fast.
It's not even like a period of time for the audience. It's immediately like, we know you're not going to like it if Chewie dies, so he's back. He's yes. back. Mm-hmm. Everything's fine.
It also adds another caper to a movie that has too many capers, right? Because they have to go rescue
Chewie. Too many capers, right? Yeah. Too many capers.
So, Babu Frick did nothing wrong. Another thing that I did like about this movie is that I liked C-3PO again for the first time in a long time.
He has something to do.
Well, and he's funny. Like,
he is funny, yeah.
Was he funny in the last... Because he's not funny in The Force Awakens when he's like, look at my red arm. Right. Is he funny in The Last Jedi? I can't remember what he does there.
He's barely in it.
Yeah. That's my memory.
He doesn't do a lot, yeah.
But, like, he's there. He's funny. He gets this moment of, like, agency. And he, like, chooses the brave option. He gets that great moment that makes the trailer. Right?
Yeah.
Where he, like, one last look at my friends, and yes, it's his new friends, not his old friends, but who cares?
It's pretty sappy, but...
But it works. It works. Yeah. Sap works in this universe.
Sure.
It works. And then, yeah, it's just immediately wiped away by the magic memory backup. I have a lot of questions about how data works in this universe.
R2's just backing up his memory.
Well,
yeah.
There's that opening, that's another tangent, I'm sorry.
There's a real ethical question there.
There sure. is, you're right. Like, sure.
That
you're
to
right.
just have someone else's memory.
Oh, R2's got all kind of stuff.
Yeah. Anyways, go on, please continue.
No, this is actually, I'm more interested in this than what I was going to say, which is that court they get the spy report from is weird to me at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And there's, in Rogue One, there's wireless transmission of data. Mm-hmm. But that's it. And it doesn't go through shields. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm more interested in this question of, is R2-D2 committing identity theft of other droids?
At the very least, like a real invasion of privacy.
Yeah, yeah, right? 100%.
Unless we assume that C-3PO can't think private thoughts because droids don't have... Listen, we... Droid rights.
Droid rights.
You know what I mean?
The best part of Solo.
Yes.
The droid uprising, yes. The Phoebe Waller-Bridge droid uprising.
Yes.
Excuse me. Well, the interesting thing is that this isn't explicit in... I can't remember which movie it's explicit in or if it's just in the larger canon, but the idea is that droids have their memories wiped mm-hmm. periodically.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that's how R2 and 3PO have personalities, because they have never, or it's been so long right. since their memory's been mm-hmm. wiped. Which, of course, is a really interesting statement about personhood, that we are our memories and,
yeah.
you know, we have a narrative about ourselves. And, of course, when 3PO gets reset, he's just like, is every day like this for you guys? Because he's a brand new self. He's tabula rasa.
Yeah, another good line. Good laugh.
Good laugh. There's some good laugh lines.
I wonder who did punch up on this, because they did pretty good.
The punch up's good.
Yeah.
There's good jokes here.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
They earned their paycheck.
But another way to think about this in terms of this idea of loss and cost, right? And I think that one of the problems that we sort of talked about here is that there's no real cost. There's no real losses other than the expected ones of like, well, you know, Carrie Fisher has died. So, you know, Leia at some point will become one with the Force, I should say.
Yeah.
The Last Jedi really grapples with limits, right? With limits and loss and failure. Mm-hmm. And like, for instance, Luke's X-Wing is submerged for years on Ahch-To. Mm-hmm. And so even at the end of the movie, when he wants to help, he cannot simply fly there, right?
Yeah.
This is something that Rian Johnson does so brilliantly, is that he takes this sort of desperation mission that you could argue is, you know, the plot of the original Star Wars. We're going to try to destroy the Death Star. We're a small force. We're outnumbered. We're going to try to do it. It's a mission of desperation. But what choice do we have, right? Mm-hmm. Rian Johnson takes that and is like, well, you can't simply retell that story over and over again because it becomes very stale. And I think we're in a different moment in 2019, 2015, 2012, whenever, than 1977, where we want a little more nuance. We don't just necessarily want the same kind of like Deus Ex Machina, like they're going to get saved by a big fleet from nowhere. So this movie, it has Rey. One of the many things that it kind of reverses is that Rey flies Luke's X-Wing. Why? Simply because it's cool that she flies his X-Wing. Now, it's still been submerged in water. Like, how long do those engines take to dry, right? To take a totally random tangent, in a movie like Interstellar, spoiler alert if you haven't seen that Christopher Nolan movie, when they're on the planet with the huge waves and they've got to fire the engines, there's actually like a time where they're sitting there and they're like, the engines are flooded, right? We've got to wait. And of course, it all fits in the narrative of like, can they get back to the ship? And there's all this tension, right? Again, so with Last Jedi, Luke is stuck on Ahch-To. He's made these choices. There are limits. Your choices put limits on your life, right? And then, of course, he uses this cool Force power of astral projection. And so the Force is able to transcend those limits. It still is a Star Wars movie. An act of desperate hope still defeats the bad guys, right? But it's within certain constraints. The Force doesn't let you just do anything, right? And I think the problem with Rise of Skywalker is, like, there's no real constraints. It's like, oh, we're just going to fly to this planet. We're going to fly to that planet. A bunch of good guys are going to show up out of nowhere because Lando and Chewie went and got them, right? We're going to kill Chewie. We're going to bring him back. Rey's going to fly Luke's X-Wing. Who cares if it's been spent decades submerged in water, right?
To come back to JJ's previous franchise engagement, right? This is actually also the problem with Into Darkness and why I think Into Darkness is Star Trek Into Darkness is not fundamentally a good film, which is that, again, we have the replay of, okay, spoilers for like all of Star Trek ever. we have the replay of Kirk, Spock, one of them dies. And what happens when these two men who are comrades in arms and have been through so much together, when one of them leaves this world, and how does the other cope with that grief, right?
And they just reverse.
And they just reverse it immediately. But not only do they reverse it immediately, I mean, the solution is in Into Darkness that they generate a serum out of Khan's super blood. I think that's like literally the line is like, I had to generate a serum out of Khan's super blood.
Somehow.
And then they never, ever, I mean, that is the last like 2 seconds of the film, right? And never do they grapple with the fact that, guess what? You just solved death. Death does not exist in the Star Trek universe anymore because all you have to do is generate a serum from Superblood, right? So
we don't even get a serum for why Palpatine comes back.
That is,
to be fair, there's nothing about clones. It's just like, I've died.
There's, to be fair, we get like 6 reasons because Charlie from Lost goes, maybe it's a clone or dark force magic or
right.
He just throws out 6 and you can just pick the one that you think
isn't his.
But I think I you're both right. Like, universes need limitations. There need to be consequences for choices. But I think what those limitations are and what those consequences are can be flexible to suit a narrative. And I think we wouldn't be so hung up on how Palpatine came back within the science/magic of Star Wars, because the line between science and magic in Star Wars is not particularly strong, if it made narrative sense. Like, if there was any kind of like hint before, but, you know, and I think the same, like, Rey flying Luke's X-Wing would make sense if there was narrative ground laid throughout these movies that, like, she has some connection to Luke, whether it be, like, she is a fan, but she's just, she has a connection to Han Solo in the first movie.
Yeah.
Right? Throughout this movie, it's a connection to Leia that I actually think, despite the limitations of the filming, like, could have actually been successful. It wasn't crazy about, like, the young CGI Luke and Leia training, but there's no narrative groundwork for these things. If there was a follow-up Star Trek movie about what the crew tries to do now that they've solved death,
right,
that would be fascinating. I would watch that movie.
Right, but that's not what Beyond ended up being about, right?
It doesn't happen, and I don't want to scapegoat anyone, but I have a theory about J.J. Abrams that goes back to Lost, the show,
right.
Television show that he made with David Lindelof. You mentioned Lindelof.
Yep.
A little bit ago, who went on to revive Watchmen, another maybe not as widely beloved, but a beloved nerd franchise.
Sure.
Property.
Mm-hmm.
Property. So they're making Lost. Lost premieres post 9/11, like very soon after, like it's like 2002, 2003, something mm-hmm. like that. ABC, big network hour-long drama. It's Robinson Crusoe, right? This plane crash lands on a deserted, seemingly deserted island.
Mm-hmm.
There's 30 survivors. And the island is full of mysteries that are scientific, magical, blah, blah, blah. But the other thing the show does is these flashbacks to the characters' lives before they crash. And this, you mentioned how good JJ is at origin stories. These flashbacks are thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the first season, you learn all these really cool things about these characters. And what happens to them in their flashback is thematically resonant with what's happening on the island. It's like a stunning achievement, this first season of the show. And it's like in the early days of like internet conversations about television, there was lots of, which I was a part of, I don't know if you all were, like following the conversation about Lost on the internet, like week to week, episode to episode. And sometimes this was like really constructive and thoughtful, and like, there were lots of interesting theories being floated around, but there was also lots of anger about this show.
Mm-hmm.
And the anger was directed in a couple of ways, and one of them was, there are all these mysteries about this island. There's a hatch. There's like this smoke monster that seems to be able to grab people. Dead fathers appear in the woods. There's a young child who seems to have magical powers. Like, where is all this going? Are there answers to these questions? And J.J. Abrams and Damon Lindelof would always say, this show isn't about the mysteries. This show is about the characters. And we on the internet would say, no.
No.
This show is about the mystery. And I think we're both wrong. I think that when we got the answers to the mysteries, we were not satisfied. Did you all watch Lost? Have you watched Lost?
So I watched the first half of the first season, and then I magically watched the finale. That is all I've seen.
What? I want to do a podcast where you explain what you think happened in the finale.
I mean...
I never watched it.
Okay. So the solution to the mysteries are not, they're not, for the most part, satisfying.
Well, unfortunately, there's one solution to the mystery,
right.
Which is that, in fact, this world has had no rules all along.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
That's the solution to all mysteries,
yes.
Boiled down to one thing.
And what we needed, but I don't think there was a, like, scientific solution to what was happening on this island that would have been satisfying. What we wanted was satisfying character arcs,
mm-hmm.
but this was a show that was, like, conceived in one era of television and then, like, aired through a new era of television. These were great characters for, like, a week-to-week non-serial show where everyone resets back, right? There's,
mm-hmm.
there's the, like, well-meaning natural leader who doesn't always get it right. There's, like, the former con woman who's trying to make a new go of it. There's the... There's the disabled person who's magically cured on the island, which is problematic for 100 reasons. There's a Han Solo figure on the island.
Mm-hmm.
But after the first couple of flashbacks, there's nowhere else to go because these characters weren't fully realized. Like, by season three, there were, like, flashbacks about the origin of a character's tattoos, which...
Who cares?
No one cared about. Right. I mean, it fell apart because the characters weren't fully realized enough to sustain six seasons of forward momentum.
Right.
And I think Lindelof and J.J. Abrams learned the two very different lessons from this. And Lindelof now makes these very tightly knit, character-driven things that are like still genre, right? He made The Leftovers, which I have not watched, but people seem to be fully satisfied by. He makes Watchmen, which goes back, and he maintains this is a remix. This is not a continuation of, but it's a continuation of Watchmen. And it does this really fascinating thing, which is it takes a clear problem with the Watchmen comic strip, which is this strip that is set in 20th century America and features one character of color, I think. And he solves this problem in a way that makes so much sense that you can't imagine it wasn't conceived of in the show. Are you okay if I spoil this?
Yeah.
You know. Okay. So the one mass vigilante in the Watchmen universe whose identity isn't known in the Watchmen universe is Hooded Justice, who in early 20th century America wears a hood over his face and a noose around his neck. And in the original Watchmen comic strip, this is a white character. Mm-hmm. And the Watchmen show just says, like, no, that's nonsense, and makes it a black character. And it totally restructured the entire universe in this fascinating way. But the show is ultimately driven by the character of his granddaughter.
Yeah.
And it's a character-driven show that does all this interesting genre stuff. And it works because it's doing both at the same time. J.J. Abrams took something else that we complained about with Lost and ran with it, which is we would complain that characters don't tell each other the secrets they know on the show. And I rewatched Phantom of Force Awakens. They're constantly shouting plot points at each other
that we've
already seen. They're kind of like, we have to find the robot. The robot has the map. And I like, feel like that's the lesson J.J. Abrams learned. And he keeps filling mystery boxes with unsatisfying solutions. But characters talk about the secrets that they know.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I think that's so accurate. Watchmen is brilliant. Lindelof did such a great job. Rise of Skywalker doesn't have... You're right, it doesn't... If you think about Finn and Poe at the beginning of the movie, and you think about them at the end of the movie, what has changed? What is different? What is their arc? There isn't one, right? If you think about Rey, she obviously has a little more of an arc. If you think about Kylo, a little more of an arc in the sense that he finally turns back to the light, becomes a Jedi. It certainly could be better developed.
Mm-hmm.
People have complained about the length of this movie. This movie's too short. This movie should be 20 minutes longer and have a lot less, like you said, a lot less plot, right? A lot less quests, a lot less things to do, and more time developing the characters.
Yeah.
And then they're introducing new characters on top of that, right? Mm-hmm. We have this storyline of Zori Bliss, played by Kerry Russell, who probably has the third coolest costume in Star Wars after Vader and Boba Fett. Amazing costume. Really cool character. When you watch it, it's like she starts out, she's mad at Poe for an old debt, so it's like Shades of Han and Lando, right? Then it becomes Rey knocks her down and like uses her lightsaber, and then it's like, oh, you're cool, so I'm going to help you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes, I'm getting off this hunk of junk. I somehow have scored this captain's medallion that I can use on my ship to make it look like a First Order ship. It's going to get me through a blockade. Then it becomes, oh, Poe, you should take this. You need this more than I do. What?
Yeah. It's the Han Solo arc over... That happened
over 5 minutes.
In 5 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I also...
And then she doesn't even go with them. She gives them the thing. Like, I believe in what you're doing. I'm not going to come with... Like, it makes no sense. It's way better if... Yeah, you space it out. Maybe she betrays them. Maybe eventually she comes around to respect them. Then she helps them. You can't just shove in. If you're going to do it in that compressed of a time, the only thing you're doing, I think you're right about JJ. I mean, she's flashy. She looks really cool. It was like a great press release, like new character. Look at this cool costume, right? She looks like the coolest Power Ranger you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is also the Lando role in the third film,
right?
And the Lando role in the second film, people on the internet didn't like, right? The Benicio del Toro character, people didn't like that plot, so he couldn't come back and fill that role, so we need a new character. And if you make it Kerry Russell, you can also give Poe a heteronormative
love interest
like puts the damper on the Finn Poe ship,
right.
But yeah, it makes
You pair off Finn with Naomi Ackie's character,
right?
Who also is a great, fascinating character,
right?
who's defected from being a stormtrooper, and there's this moment of recognition where she's like, wait, you're a stormtrooper? He's like, wait, you're a stormtrooper? And you could have done something with that. Yeah. That could have been a whole story, but really all they do is just run around.
Yeah.
They don't change as people.
Yeah. That was a great moment. That little exchange was really nice.
Yeah.
But thank God we do learn in the visual dictionary that most black people in the Star Wars universe are related to each other.
Yeah. Yes, because apparently she's Lando's daughter.
Possibly, maybe. It's actually
coming to Disney Plus in 2021 or something. Who knows?
Is that better or worse than my read of the scene when I was watching it, which is that we were supposed to believe that Lando was hitting on her? There's no good interpretation of that weird scene.
No, there's not at all. And it is another thing that's sort of like you're stuffing into an already full turkey.
Well, again, right?
you don't need anymore.
If you cut out some of this stuff about daggers and Sith fleets and wayfinders, then you could have had a cool story where she meets Lando in the middle, mm-hmm. and they're on a mission together, and they actually learn about each other and share their experiences, and then put some pieces together. Oh, wait, you were here. Whatever. Like, right. If we find out in the course of the movie that she's his daughter, and you get some character development of both of them. What is older Lando like? You know, what has he been up? We hear a little bit about what he's been up to, but like, how has he changed since we saw him? Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the Battle of Endor or whatever. And who is this new person? And what? Yeah, you could do a story about that, but it takes time. That takes screen time. It takes writing. It takes
And this is why I say I think. I've moved from mining metaphors to cooking metaphors, but this needed longer in the oven, right?
Because
that's the kind of thing that you come back to a script a month later and say, you know, this is just too much stuff that's going on. We need to pull this scene out. And maybe it goes to story group and we do something with it in a tie-in. But there's not enough time to sit with the script because of Disney's, like, totally self-enforced breakneck timeline. That there was no chance ever to sit with what they came up with and say, is this the right place to begin the movie? Mm-hmm. Do the dead need to speak?
If they're gonna speak, can we hear them speak and see people's live reactions to them speaking?
Film is an audible medium. We can hear the dead speak.
Listen, like there's a version of this in which the first act is Palpatine is the revealing crawl, right? himself is the crawl, 100%. And that would be fascinating.
100%.
Yeah, not somehow Palpatine has returned.
Scattered gasps. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
I mean, like you said, like the Watcher and Writers Room, they spent 10 months on the pilot.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes. That's why that show is so good, because there's a lot to work out, and there's a lot of they have a lot to think about and how to blend. And it's the same challenge, right? Taking beloved characters and source material and revitalizing it and telling a new story with it, right?
So, and source material and characters who have been treated poorly
in
recent memory.
Sure.
And we have to kind of counter the negative connotations with what Zack Snyder has done to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is so fascinating to me because I think, I mean, we are all professors of English, right? We all teach English at a college level, and we teach process and the need to take time with things. So it's interesting to me that entertainment, people who do this for a living have still somehow not figured out this crucial element, which is that you have to sit with things for a while. Just because you can make a movie that fast does not mean that you will make a movie that fast that is good.
Well, I think this is maybe part of the, speaking of lessons that were learned or weren't learned, I mean, this is the Disney Pixar story all over again, right? Disney Animation went into this huge, huge drought where they couldn't make a movie that was a hit, because basically they didn't respect any of the creators, and the various executives who didn't have artistic backgrounds were kind of calling the shots, and a lot of it was deadline driven. It was like, if you can get your movie done by this date, then you'll get a deadline, and if you can't, they were pitting projects against each other. There's this really negative culture. And then Pixar was churning out all these hits. Why? Because it was more creative driven, and they were thinking about story, like, what are the key emotions of the characters the story is about, right? And then Disney kind of came around. It was like, oh, well, we should just acquire Pixar. We should basically pay them to do what we've been failing to do. And again, like the MCU, they work their way into figuring out you have to have a coherent story that you develop over a number of years. And for whatever reason with this, they didn't like Lucas's scripts. They figured Kathleen Kennedy could do no wrong, and they just were kind of like, yep, yeah, we're just going to go for it. We're going to make back our $4.5 billion, which they have.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to, we don't have time to litigate Scorsese right now. But the, you know, Martin Scorsese, has distinguished what he does, which is cinema, from what the MCU is, which is, theme park ancillary. He has a better term than I'm coming up with right now, but that basically
he's just said they're theme parks.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
They're theme park rides.
And is what he said. And I don't want to like adhere to his hierarchy. And I think cinema is the wrong word, as I watched his most recent film across 3 nights on Netflix. and it took me 3 nights. But the grain of truth that's in what he's saying is that your shareholders don't care about the creative process.
Right.
They care about whether the movie's going to come out in a time to maximize the return on their investment in Galaxy's Edge and in these various tie-in novels and in this big AAA video game that's coming out. And I don't think we're going to get that. I mean, we're going to talk about The Mandalorian in just a minute. And that's, I feel like, maybe the last place where we're going to get that sort of thoughtful. And I think it's because Disney didn't expect it to do what it's done. And I wonder if they're going to ruin it too.
But here's the thing, I disagree, because I think that there's a way to adhere to deadline and, you know, ship when you said that you were going to ship, right? And to still have satisfying story that speaks to the things that we care about in Star Wars. And the way that you do that is that you have to be willing to put that universe through the experience of loss.
And it's not like HBO doesn't have shareholders, right? Or FX.
Yeah. Right.
And they've just decided, we care about awards.
Yeah.
We care about people talking about our shows, right? And that's why you get something like Watchmen.
This wasn't a defense of Disney. Let me just...
Sure.
No, I'm absolutely not defending the shareholder priorities.
No, I know,
just,
but...
I think that's where it comes from. They gave... And George Lucas took, I should say, what, $7 billion for this?
Mm-hmm.
And...
I don't know. I said yes, like I knew what it was.
I think it's $4.5 billion, and then he got some undisclosed Disney stock.
Billions of dollars. Says he took it on faith they were going to make his movie. He could have gotten that in writing, right? I mean, if they're going to drop $4 million, he could kick a billion back and they'd make his script, right? I mean, I don't, and I'm saying this as someone who's also fooled by this. I don't know, like, why we're surprised by this, I guess.
Yeah. I think I'm surprised just because Last Jedi was so good.
Yeah.
Right? It's almost, now it looks like, how did that even get made?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In light of the new one, where it just seems like they lost their nerve, like you said earlier. Yeah. It seems like, which we haven't even talked about, we don't need to get into all the details of, like, the social media controversy, which a lot of it was manufactured or at least amplified by bots and things like that. But they just looked at, like, oh, people are unhappy. Like, we're Disney. We can't make people unhappy.
Right.
Right? We have to market to the broadest possible audience. And some people didn't like this, so let's play it safe. Let's bring back beloved characters.
Mm-hmm. And I think the safest possible audience, which is what you think of as your existing fan base, right? Which is the most vocal online.
Yeah, but at least by box office, Last Jedi was more popular.
Yeah,
right?
It
had a broader appeal in some ways. Now, some of that could be, oh, too many movies in too short of a time frame, but a lot of it is the movie itself. If there was more buzz around this movie, it would have cracked $1 billion sooner.
If the buzz was better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Last Jedi, truly for me, is the watermark of what Star Wars can be and do, and what Star Wars can say about our own sort of experience of the universe, our contemporary kinds of anxieties and issues. And I think I mostly just feel... I'm very happy The Mandalorian exists, and I cannot wait to talk about it. But I mostly feel let down by the fact that Rise of Skywalker sold me a conclusion, a change in the universe, something that mattered. And then what it gave me was nostalgic drivel, afraid of its own success, afraid to say anything, afraid to ever contemplate Star Peace. Yeah.
I agree with all of that. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, let's write a spec script for Star Peace. Episode 10, Star Peace.
You got it.
Babu Frick is in the New Galactic Senate. For sure.
We
haven't done enough with the scale of creatures in the Star Wars universe, and he's so cute.
His hands are jumbo size.
Well, so he can manipulate. That's why he can manipulate the wires in the back of C-3PO's old-timey robot innards. Yeah. Okay. Any other last words on Skywalker?
Apparently we're all Skywalkers.
Let's let the two suns set.
Let the past die.
Let the past
kill it. Kill it if you have to. Oh. On that note, I think we should call it. This has been the end of a very long conversation about the Skywalkers.
Check out part two of this episode for more on Star Wars. We'll be talking with Dr. Susanna Morris about the possibility of Afrofuturism in the Star Wars galaxy.